So, really, what I'm going to try and do is provide sort of a macro view, and the view that I'm going to present is not exclusively talking about museums, science centers. It's really talking about lifelong science learning. Walter's going to specifically talk about the role that science centers can and are playing in Europe in lifelong science learning. And then Lynn is using an American phrase, he's going to back clean up here, and is going to, again, take a broader view and talk about, again, the implications of this for lifelong science learning, and dare I say, even building a scientific mind. What a novel thought that would be. Okay, so just to give you some general background, believe it or not, we really do live in a learning society. There's a lot of rhetoric about that, but it's not just rhetoric, it is reality. And people do learn all the time. Actually, always, we always have lived in a learning society. That's the dirty secret. Humans always have been learning creatures. It's just that we are now painfully aware of it. I know there's a lot of conversation and a lot of folks, particularly from developing countries, who are very concerned about ensuring that there is formal education, that there is schooling for children because of the opportunities that affords. But it's useful to have as a perspective that even in the more developed countries in the West, that the average adult spends only 3% of their life participating in any formal instruction. And that's in the developed world. And even children who we tend to focus on, again, when we talk about tend to use the word learning, education, and school as if those are synonyms, which they're not. Even children only spend roughly 15% of their waking hours in school. The vast majority of people's lives are spent outside of school. And dare I say, they're learning all the time. Most of what we learn through what we call pre-choice learning. Pre-choice learning is the learning we do when we get to choose what to learn, where to learn, with whom to learn. And that actually represents the dominant form of learning in our society. And then finally, one thing that is happening clearly is the traditional boundaries between where and when and how we learn and why we learn are breaking down. And so the boundaries between school and non-school, between the workplace and leisure, between leisure and schooling, all of those boundaries are breaking down. So that's just sort of the big picture. And to make this a little more graphic, if you think about a life space, and you've got a lifespan from 0 to 70, 80 on years, and just on general, we'll say that people are awake from 7 in the morning to 11 at night, unless you're in the Southern Hemisphere. If you're in Rio, then the time difference, there's a shift in that time frame. 12 months out of the year. Okay? So there is this little block of time in those years when you're in formal pre-college education, and if you're so fortunate to go to university, there's another little chunk of time, but there's a lot of life space in there that is not consumed by that formal schooling. The truth is we learn from many different places in many different ways. In fact, there's an entire learning infrastructure of which increasingly important, not just go around the circle. The size and relationship of these circles are totally arbitrary. There's the internet, there's print media, books, magazines, newspapers. We learn from families and friends. We learn through our faith-based organizations in the workplace. We learn from a wide variety of community organizations. Again, if you are thinking in terms of a Western context, there are everything from informal groups like book groups to more formal organizations like Elder Hostel, or you can take courses at a free university or something like that. Museums are in quote because, in fact, there's a whole range of museum-type institutions, from zoos and aquariums to science centers to natural history museums. Obviously, electronic media, TV, radio, film, schools, universities, etc. I'm sorry?
Books are where they're.
Books.
Yeah, yep. Print.
Print media, books. And Speaking of books, this is based on research that I did, and my colleagues and I did, initially in Los Angeles, and we've sort of replicated these results in Tucson, Arizona, where basically we asked the public, so where do you get your science information from? How do you, when you want to find out about science, what sources of information do you use? And as you can see, those numbers add up to way more than 100%. That's because people are using multiple resources. Statistically, the 1, 2, and 3 are not different. I know in Europe, similar results have shown television media to be at the top, but once again, there's no statistical difference between 74% and 76%, so that might as well be number one. What's interesting is that 4 and 5 are not statistically different either. School courses, science museums, zoos, and aquariums are not significantly different. And then likewise, 6 and 7 are not statistically different, and then there's a drop. The other thing that's interesting to note is we've done this research now 3 times, 97, 2000, and most recently in 2004. And there's definitely a trend there in terms of the internet. But even in 2004, the internet is not in any way competing in terms of science information at the moment with those more traditional sources. That's not to say that won't continue to change. But that's general information about science. If you ask people a very different question, and you basically approach them and say, all of us know a little bit of science, is there an area of science that actually you would say you know as much, if not more, than most of your friends and neighbors? Most people actually say yes, particularly if you help them understand science in the broadest sense, not just physics or chemistry, but how the internal combustion engine works, or how the chemistry of your garden soil, things like that, sort of everyday science. If you ask that kind of question, then the majority of people say, yes, I know something at least as much, if not more. Now, what we haven't tested is the veracity of that, but we have actually asked people, so talk to us about that. And most people are fairly credible in those responses. And we asked them, and what was the source of your information in terms of knowing about that area of science, the science that you feel you know something about? And when you frame the question that way, what you find is that roughly a quarter of the public says that they acquired that very specific knowledge through their work. Roughly a third say they acquired that very specific knowledge through schooling, but nearly half claim that they acquired that very specific knowledge through some kind of a hobby, personal interest, through reading, essentially free choice learning. And so on that note, just sort of leave you with this overall notion that learning in general, science learning in particular, is not something that happens in one place at what time, but it's a lifelong process. And if we're going to take seriously this notion of lifelong learning as a never-ending cumulative process, then we need to design our educational systems in ways that support that lifelong process. So with that, Walter, move. And actually,
while you are doing it.
So most of you might have had dreams last night. I hope so. I hope they were good. I'm not going to analyze your dreams, of course. But the good thing with the dreams today is that, and maybe some are still having some. The good thing about dreams, or the bad thing, is that today they can provoke dreams. I don't know if you know that. That with researchers in Israel, they have found out a machine, and they can put your brain on the machine, and they stimulate some part of your brain at some parts of the night when you are in this particular stage of your sleep, and they stimulate, they put in, send you keywords that you have decided up front, and music that you have decided up front, and that means that when they do that, they can create a dream that you want to have. And they say that today only it works in 20% of the cases, but maybe in the future between 80% and 95%. So that's fascinating, isn't it? That the machine can create the dreams that you want to have. Do you think it's fascinating, or do you think it's scary? I think people are a bit divided about that, and that they are divided about science in general and technological innovation in general. So we had this fascination about science in the 60s, about with space exploration and all these kind of things, and today we see that we have a bit more problems with this general public have the vision that they have about science, that most of the scientific innovation and technological innovation is a bit scary. The most of the fears of society today are linked with technological innovation. But this being said, we are in this society, we live with it, and science at the same time is part of the development, general development of society. So what I want to talk about is how this debate that takes place in Europe and how we as science in the field can respond to that, because we are living in our professional daily life facing these problems, these both attitudes of the public about science. It's not like it was 30 years ago, so what should we do? And maybe to start with this very important statement. Can you hear me? Yes? From here? Okay. You might have heard about the Lisbon Agenda. The Lisbon Agenda is for Europe to become the most competitive and dynamic knowledge-based society in 2010. That is very ambitious, of course, but that means, in the first place, if we want to do that, that we have to increase the human potential of research in such a way that we can achieve that. That means 600,000 to 700,000 new researchers, additional researchers for the European Union in 2010. In the actual situation of this debate that I just described about the fears and the complexity of science, we see that we will not probably reach that. And still the Commission thinks, and I think most of the people in Europe think, that to get there, to find these researchers, to make this competitive knowledge-based society, education is core. So it's not only an economical objective, it's an educational objective that the Commission has put forward, and it's a very ambitious one. That means that by 2010 we should not only be competitive on economical level, but that we should in Europe be the world leader in terms of quality of its education and training, and I think it was so important that I could off twice. So it might be right. Okay. I okay. Playing nice. So this has been written into very, very precise objectives what education should achieve in Europe by 2010. And these are terms that you all, of course, are familiar with. So MS is member states should have the rate of early school leavers reach 10% or less. So, and all this you can read it. I'm not going into details because my point is not to go into the details of the objectives of the Commission, but they are very, very clearly expressed and they are very ambitious as well. They have done an evaluation after 3 years, and it doesn't seem to work quite well at the moment. Still, the objectives are there, but we think that lifelong learning is still, the uptake of that is still low. Exclusion remains. There are not substantial increase of over-investment in human resources, etc., etc. So, but the objectives are still there, and we want to go there. I just take this because it was mentioned yesterday by the speech about the ROSE project. The ROSE project, that is one of the outcomes of the ROSE project. The ROSE project is trying to find what is the attitude about youngsters, what the youngsters have about science. And this is really from Norway. This is the youngsters, you know, how they look at scientists. You can clearly identify who is lying there. Well, who is the scientist? The scientist is not the one who sleeps. The scientist is the other one, right? So an even more... thank you. I will not make it. So I will do it. So they say, that is from, I think, from Denmark maybe, or from Norway as well. So they see, I think they experiment with animals and kill them, and then they develop poisonous gases and atomic bombs. That's what scientists come here. Think about scientists. In the north of Europe, as it was mentioned yesterday, it's not the same thing worldwide. In developing countries, you have a reverse opinion about that. But so that is... what we live in.
I'll tell you what.
Yes, do that. Okay. Yes, thank you. What are the reasons why youngsters have this attitude towards science in Europe? We have done, well, the European Union has done a quite large analysis of what education means in Europe today, and they have come up with a number of reasons. This research has been done by Professor Sjöberg from Norway, and the possible reasons are: the curriculum is outdated, science is difficult and untrendy, there is lack of quality teachers, anti- and quasi-science alternatives that exist. The film that just is issued this week about the brain and the mind. I don't know if you, and particle physics, have you heard about that? Where people, where the particle physics are presented as a science, but that people can influence matter with their brain and things like that. So it's quite a very important film, because they put a lot of pressure to make people go and see it. It's paid by a sect, and so there is quasi science in there. It's terrible. So if the large public will go and see that, it's a real question. So these exist, and people, they are believing in that. In France, for example, there is a PhD given to someone who's an astrologist. I don't know if you heard about that. So the scientific community digs his own grave, so to say. We have stereotypical images of scientists and engineers. Disagreement among researchers is perceived as problematic, and so on. So all the list, these things have been coming out of the research doing from the European Union about how they see, how the youngsters see science. So the general findings are that science teaching is old-fashioned, carrying an implicit image that science is mainly a massive body of authoritative and unquestionable knowledge. I think that that is very important, that we see that the question that how you can be critical towards science is not accepted, it's not in the schools, it's not existing in schools, and that is something that the children do not accept, since there are other things where they can be much more critical, other areas where they can be. So I'm not going into details. So from there, so we have one thing. We want in 2010 to have this knowledge-based society. Education is important, but on the other hand, we find that our youngsters, they are not interested. So what is the Commission saying? We have an average age of science professionals rising, and they are not. We have a gap. There will be no scientific professionals coming up. And the process of choosing a science-based or science-related career is characterized by a series of opinion-forming influences and experiences. The choice of subjects at secondary level and choices on entering tertiary or further education, and the quality and effectiveness of primary and secondary level education have a great impact on the decision process. But recent analysis reveal that the falling interest among young people for science studies and careers can be attributed in large part to the lack of appeal of study courses at school. And that is something that we all knew implicitly, but no one dared to say, and 3 years ago, for the first time, it was really put on the table and say, if there is a problem in scientific teaching in schools and in the vision that youngsters have and attitudes that they have towards schools, towards science, in the first place, it's the school who is responsible. And if we have to do something, we have to do something in the schools and not outside. So, from the same experience, the Commission found that there are other forms of learning that occur in the world, and that they are in the informal settings. And the tentative here is to try to find what is good in the informal learning scene and transfer that to the formal education system. And there was a call launched 3 years ago that was called the European Education Initiative, that aims, and that is the description of that, to find what in the informal learning field can be used to transform and adapt the formal science teaching in schools. So, as a network of science centers, we have decided that we would really respond to that, because that is our task. Science centers, they have all the tools in their activities to respond to a call like that. We have the public. 25% of the visitors of science centers are school groups. 60% of visitors of science centers worldwide are less than 25 years of age. So we have the people coming there. It's our profession to do that. I'm not going into more details of that. But so we decided to respond to that, and we have set up a project that is a pencil project, and that's for, yeah, as the acronym doesn't say it, of course, totally really, it's the Permanent Resource Center for Informal Learning, and that is based on three main things: pilot projects, 14 pilot projects all over Europe, where science centers, science museums are the core of a local network involving schools, teachers' associations, companies, academics, etc., to set up innovative projects that aims at the end to transform some part of the curriculum into new teaching methods. I can go very quickly through this, because the pilot projects are really so diverse that we try to attract, to tackle different kinds of subjects. Disciplinary approaches, how can chemistry be teached in primary schools, for example, or mathematics for children of 3 years of age, or interdisciplinary approaches? How can you tackle global change, climate change, into schools? How do you do that in an interdisciplinary way? Or education techniques like peer-to-peer education and this kind of stuff. So these are the projects that are on the table, 14 of them. The new thing here is that they are observed by two universities who have to identify at the end of the project which are the elements of quality and innovation that makes that these projects can be transformed into lessons into schools. And that we will see in 2 or 3 years from now. And I will end by, I have to end, I understand, by that. There will be a portal that on the web that will show that, and it's called Explorer. And okay, let's go out of that. Okay, sorry, I have no time.
Thank you so much.
I can start before the presentation is there. Indeed, there's a wonderful role that free choice learning institutions, such as museums, science centers, radio, television can play in supporting the learning of school-age children. But I think one of the things that is extremely important to remember is that we live long lives. Hopefully we're all going to live into our 80s, and we may end school in our teenage years if we're lucky enough to. There's a whole lifetime of opportunities for learning, and as we all know, science is changing so much that actually, I can come over here. Yeah. Science is changing so much that there's no way we can actually know everything about science when we graduate from school anyway. And so what I would like to just say a few things about is the notion of how do we both support the stuff that Walter's talking about that complements and enhances schooling, but how can we tap into these resources across people's lifetimes? So as John mentioned, the lines really are blurring. We learn when we travel. We are doing all sorts of learning in our in the workplace. And actually, what we really should be thinking about as we think about lifelong science learning is rather than thinking all about the institutional systems that support that learning, we need to be thinking about the learners themselves and helping them navigate and choose the resources that are going to be most useful to them. And in fact, what we need to be thinking about is how do we integrate free choice learning, schooling, and workplace learning across a person's lifetime. Depending upon their age, they're going to at times be very focused. If you're school aged, a lot of the ways you're going to be learning at that point in your life are through schooling. But as you become a young professional, you're going to focus a lot in the workplace and on weekends. And certainly once you are an older person, you have this whole world of learning infrastructure to take advantage of. And so I think that what we would like to propose as a way of thinking about the building of the scientific mind is that we need to create this integrated network of resources across people's lifetimes and help them see here are the resources and how you can tap into them. So this learning society of tomorrow, just a few ideas of perhaps ways we might think about it. First of all, pretty universally, there are departments of education in countries. And it's interesting, those departments of education focus often on teaching rather than learning, and focus on children rather than the learners in a society. Mm-hmm. So if we want to have a society that really reflects tomorrow, perhaps we need to be talking about a department of learning. And that department of learning is not just focused on school-age children, but focused across people's lifetimes. Another interesting and very provocative idea that we get a lot of attention for is that, in fact, if we look at the expenditure of money in our societies for education, there's a large expenditure of money for schools, despite the fact that, as John pointed out, the actual time we spend in school is very short. And we would propose that we need to really rethink this notion of our learning and educational budgets and really think about how can we perhaps give each person a learning budget across their lifetime that they can use in ways that make sense to them. We, once again, that implication is that the funding for education would be distributed across the learning landscape. And as I suggested yesterday, and I know has happened in a lot of our smaller groups, talking about the fact that everyone in their lifetime has the potential for being both a learner but also a teacher. And that another part of this this network is helping to connect people with knowledge with other people that are interested in that knowledge. And I guess I would just leave you with, you know, a wonderful dream, sort of windows with Walter, this notion that much of this sounds like we could not possibly do it, but if we can imagine it and if we can be creative and really use our scientific minds, I think we can create a new vision for learning in our societies. Thank you.
Thank you.